Well, this talk, as some of the others, I'm intending to give a bit of an overview here on multi-state models. That was suggested at the beginning that when I was asked to speak, that might be a good idea. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about multi-state models and just survey the area. And then I'll talk about incomplete data in connection with multi-state models. And I'll talk about some applications and illustrations without a lot of detail. I'll try for broad coverage rather than much detail. And I'll talk a little bit about estimation and analysis. And then I'll talk a little bit towards the end about gaps in methodology. So multi-state models and are models in which they're stochastic process models in which the individuals in some population can occupy different states over time. And so the response that we're interested in is the sample paths that they trace through these states over time. So I'll set up the notation so that yi of t represents the state that a particular individual is in at time t. We'll assume here that there's just a finite number of states, although you might want to make it countable in some applications. So then most of you are probably familiar with this from stochastic processes courses, but one could define transition probabilities. Pij tt plus s is just the probability that given that you're in state I at time t, that you're in state j at time t plus s. And then there would also be, in some cases, one might be interested in state prevalence or occupancy probabilities. In particular, for example, if everybody started in the same state at time zero, then these would just be the marginal probabilities of being in state J at time T. Now, of course, these things are often of interest. That's why I mention them here. They're often of interest, but they don't, of course, specify the processes mathematically. You need more than that. So to specify the processes, this can be done in different but equivalent ways, but the kind of standard way of looking at these things nowadays would be through the transition intensity functions, which are kind of like hazard functions in survival analysis. So in particular, if we're at some time point T, and if I let H of T denote the process history for a given individual up to time t, then lambda ijt conditioned on that history is just the, if you like, it's the instantaneous probability of a transition from state I, given that you're in state I at time t, or just before time t. It's the probability of a transition to state j over the next little interval of time. So the intensity is defined as a limit, but the kind of like instantaneous transition probabilities. Now, there's different kinds of processes that one might want to work with. One type is Markov processes, where the transition intensities don't actually depend on the history. They really just depend on the current time. So that's the kind of process that's been studied a lot. And you can do quite a bit in terms of statistical methodology with those kinds of processes. Another type of process, which is kind of rather different, is the semi-Markov process family, where the transition intensities actually depend on the history only through the time since you entered the current state. So B of T is the time since the state that you're now in was entered. Okay, now, in general, of course, maybe neither of, members of neither of these families may actually describe the process that you're looking at. But these are rather two extremes in a sense, although, of course, they overlap these two families. If the transition intensities are constant, then the model is a time-homogeneous Markov process, and it's also a renewal process, a semi-Markov process. Okay. Now, in practice, of course, we've also got covariates, and I'll bring those in a minute. And when one does analysis, though, the predominant methods of analysis are to put in covariates, typically in multiplicative ways, but not necessarily, into these intensity functions. And you can put in, you can start with a sort of a canonical process or a baseline process that's either Markov or semi-Markov, and then you can put in internal time-varying covariates that might include functions of h of t. So you can actually, a lot of the analysis that gets done, in fact, probably almost all of the analysis that gets done is built on using one of these two families along with modulating internal covariates if they're necessary. Okay. Now, incomplete data, the sorts of incomplete data I'll mention here are mostly to do with intermittent observation. There are other things that come up, but intermittent observation is a typical problem, and that was mentioned this morning in the talks as well, that usually when you've got like a Z of T process or something, you can't actually observe it continuously in time, so you end up getting measurements at different time points, and that's often true here too. So intermittent observation means you only see the individual subjects at discrete times. And so that only the y, in the most extreme case, all you know is the state that they're in at those different time points. In less extreme cases, you so that transitions between those times are unobserved. They might be able to be inferred sometimes, but you don't know when they occurred. In some applications, you can retrospectively perhaps ascertain the transitions that were made since the last time, and I'll talk a bit about that later. Initial conditions is another thing. Of course, a lot of processes, especially in observational studies, but also in some clinical studies, at time zero or whenever you're starting the study, there's some history in the past for those subjects that might be relevant to modeling the actual process that you're looking at. And we call that, I'll call that initial conditions. That term's often used in econometrics. Okay? So in other words, I might need some, at the first time that I see the I subject, there may be something about that subject's history that I really should have in order to write down the intensity function starting at that first time. Of course, then you, as usual, we can have loss to follow-up. There could be missing covariate values. That can be true whether or not you have intermittent observation or not. And there could be measurement error. And the measurement error could be either with respect to the actual times that the transitions occur, or they could be with respect to covariates. So those are some types of incomplete data that you run into in practical situations. Okay, so I'll just do just go through a few examples. Multi-state models have a lot of potential for representing a lot of different processes, and even sometimes where you've got continuous marker processes and things, it's sometimes useful to discretize those and look at them in a multi-state framework. Of course, probably the simplest process after the basic survival process, where there's only two states, alive and dead, and you can go from one to two. Slightly more complicated process is this thing called the illness-death process often, in which state one means the person's alive and free of the disease. State two means that they're alive, but now they've got the disease or the condition. So the condition might be, for example, diabetes or cardiovascular disease. And then state three is perhaps dead, you know, just for example. Another application, for example, organ transplantation, where people enter state one when they go on a waiting list for an organ transplant. State two means they get the transplant. State three means they died. And in these kinds of cases, we're interested in these transitions and in modeling and understanding these transitions and in understanding perhaps the way that they're affected by explanatory variables or process history. Another kind of thing it's good for is the interactions between two different events. So there might be two types of events, A and B, you're interested in. There's a lot in the literature, of course, on competing risks, which simply looks at the time till the first of different types of events occurs. But more generally, you know, you're interested in following people after the first event occurs. And so, for example, you might have menopause and breast cancer. So here's a woman free of breast cancer, has not yet reached menopause, Let's say A is reaching menopause and B is being diagnosed with breast cancer. So I might be interested in these different paths. And in particular, I'm interested perhaps in how the risk of the transition to breast cancer or the incidence of breast cancer, whether it might be related to whether the person's already, woman has already reached menopause. Another situation is with recurrent events and a failure time. So this is a very common thing nowadays. There's lots of work on longitudinal models where there's a longitudinal process that could be continuous or could be discrete. And then there's an associated failure time of some type. And we saw examples of that this morning. So for example, strokes as the recurrent events and death. So I'm considering cases where that process, the longitudinal process, is a recurrent event of some kind. But it could be events of different types. So here's an example I'll show you. Children with hydrocephalus and water on the brain, in simple, somewhat crude language, have to have shunts put in to drip the fluid away from their cranial area. And it's usually done with an internal shunt that just drips it down into the abdominal cavity. One of the things is that these shunts sometimes fail, necessitating at least partial replacement. And the failures, about 80 or 90% of them are due to either infection or obstructions. The shunt doesn't drain properly, but there are some other causes too. And there's not insubstantial mortality in these individuals as well, depending on the actual reason that they have the shunt or have the hydrocephalus. So this would look like this. So a child gets the initial surgery, they get a shunt inserted after their condition is diagnosed, and then this indicates one means that the first shunt fails, and then they would get some replacement of a part or all of the shunt, and then it might fail again, and then it might fail again, and so on. You can get a lot of failures. Data I've looked at with people at neurosurgeons at SickKids, there are some children may have as many as 10 or 20, of these events that get really persistent infections and things like that. And then this F here would stand for failure or death, say, in this case. Now, actually, though, at each level, in fact, you can blow this picture up because I could replace one with this picture that actually has the cause of the actual failure, the shunt failure, in as well. So it could be due to obstruction, infection, other failures, or it could die. So the subject could die. So one here, there's really like three things branching off this: obstruction failure, infection failure, other failure, or death. Another situation that there's a lot of discussion about and a lot of concern these days, especially with, you know, the widespread use of observational data, but also with some clinical trials and things, is dependent loss to follow-up. So if when there's intermittent observation of subjects, then things get a little bit more interesting in some ways. They're interesting enough when you follow people continuously in time. But one of the issues that can occur is, when do you declare a subject lost to follow-up? So I'll show you some data later with these people at SickKids with the shunts, in which they were supposed to come back to the clinic either about every 6 months or every 12 months. So you've got this big database, but you look at the database and you analyze the data at some point, you see that there's a whole lot of kids there that you haven't seen for 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. Now, what should you do with those guys? Should you declare them lost to follow-up, perhaps? But what should you put in as their censoring time, for example, if I wanted to do a mortality analysis? So there's issues about that. And as is well known, I mean, in a lot of books on survival, they'll look at censoring as a competing risk. So you can either die or fail, or you can be censored, right? And that's often useful. So that's a two-state model. But another way to think of it often, if I had just a simple two-state model, but then I could put in loss to follow-up as another state. And one of the really crucial issues is whether loss to follow-up depends on which state I'm in. That could be problematic if it did. Another application of multi-state models is cumulative cost models. For example, in cancer studies now, they do a lot of work on measuring quality of life. And one way to do this is to say that at any given time point, a person is in one of some, you know, finite number of states. And attached to each state is a score, which is like a quality of life rate function. So you accumulate quality of life at a rate that's dependent on whatever state you're in at that particular time point. And of course, multi-state models and basically are good because I can accumulate data on quality of life just by integrating over the time spent in the various states along with the actual score for the quality of life in those states. The same thing could apply to things like medical costs, where depending what state you're in, you accrue cost at different rates. Okay, now I'm just going to say a little wee bit about estimation and analysis, because there's obviously not time to say a lot. But for one thing, if you've got continuous observation with nothing missing, and you have intensity-based models, then, so sort of like Jeremy Taylor's talking about this morning, if I actually specify this stochastic process so I can write down a likelihood, then actually, in principle, things are reasonably straightforward, although not computationally, if you start bringing in random effects and time-dependent covariates and things. But in principle, it's straightforward. You can, i.e., I can write down the likelihood function. For some models, in particular Markov and semi-Markov, and if I don't have time-varying covariates that are too complicated, I could probably even use survival analysis software. And there's a nice book by Turnow and Gramsch. By the way, the references are in the last two pages, so if you just look on the net, on the website here, you'll be able to pull off any of the references I mentioned. So in Turnow and Gramsch's book, Extending the Cox Model, there's a lot of examples of this. And in my book on survival analysis, in the last chapter, I discuss this. So you can do a lot. But of course, that's in estimating in transition intensities. It does not mean that it's necessarily going to be very easy to deal with things like estimation of transition probabilities, though, which is another matter. But you can look at the effects of covariates on transition intensities fairly readily. With Markov models, there's a whole lot more available. If you look in the book by Anderson, Borg, and Gill and Keiding, the Springer-Verlag book, 1993, you'll see lots of stuff in there about non-parametric methods. The semi-parametric Cox model for survival analysis extends in a direct way to Markov models just here. We just simply put in a Cox model for each transition intensity. I mean, typically this would probably, the beta would probably also maybe have an IJ attached to it as well. Parametric models you can fit pretty readily with survival or generalized optimization software. And so basically, the key point is that the way that this analysis is done is that every time you enter a new state, you sort of define a survival time that's equal to the time until you exit that state or the time at which you exit that state and treat that as the survival time, except that it's sort of competing risk, because if in a multi-state model, there might be several other states you can go to. But that's all the key idea is. So if you can do competing risk survival analysis, you should be able to do a lot of analysis with multi-state models. There are some little issues about left truncation and stuff, but I won't worry about it. And when the clock starts, you know, what's the zero point for the survival time? It depends on if you've got a Markov or a semi-Markov model. Okay. Now, intermittent observation, though, is much, much more difficult to handle. Time homogeneous Markov models, or maybe piecewise constant transition intensities, are not too hard to handle. I refer you to a paper there, and there is an R function that Rob Gentleman wrote that deals with some of this. But generally speaking, it gets difficult with full process models. So there really is a shortage of methodology here, both computational and I suppose perhaps methodological ideas. The one exception is with equally spaced observation times, and you can bring in methods for longitudinal discrete data or categorical responses, and I'll say a little bit about that later on. Another issue, of course, is missing covariates. Here, it's safe to say, I think in this area, almost nothing has been done. Grace Yee yesterday talked about dealing with just like measurement error, for example, with just single repeated events. When you get into multi-state models more generally, there's really very little there. Okay, some gaps in methodology. Well, let's focus on studies with intermittent observation of subjects. So one example I'll just mention, and I'll just take a short look at. Like what I'm going to do here, by the way, I'll take a look at just a few topics: dependent loss to follow-up, goodness of fit tests or model checking, missing covariates, response selective observation, measurement error, and modeling issues. So I obviously spend about two, three minutes on each of these. But so one example that's interesting in connection with what I want to say next is our longitudinal surveys. So statistical agencies around the world, and in particular Statistics Canada, do a lot of longitudinal surveys. One example is SLID, the Survey of Labor and Income Dynamics, in which people are seen usually every year, perhaps every 2 years, and at that those times data are collected on the individuals, and they attempt to collect data retrospectively on what's happened to the individual since the last time they were seen. Similar examples come up in things like the disease clinic example I mentioned a few minutes ago, but I'll maybe say one more thing about that. So one of the things here is concern about loss to follow-up. Because so suppose individuals are actually seen or observed, inspected at discrete times, but that what can happen is that an individual may be found to be lost to follow-up at any time age A. So that means, in other words, that I saw them. Let's just consider the kind of monotone dropout thing here, so that I basically what I'm going to do is assume that I see them up to time AJ minus 1. I see them at each of those times, but at AJ the person doesn't appear. That's the way it usually is in the longitudinal surveys. Somebody goes missing and then they're assumed to be lost to follow up. Well, not always. Sometimes they may come back the next year. Okay. Now, the standard methodology assumes that we have independent inspections. Now, it doesn't mean that the probability I see somebody is completely independent of their process that I'm studying, the Y of T process, but it means that, for example, that the next inspection time after I see somebody, say at AJ minus 1, depends only on the history that I've observed up to AJ minus 1. So suppose I see somebody at AJ minus 1, but at AJ they're lost to follow-up. I can't find them to do take my observations. So the real worry is that what if loss to follow-up is related not just to the history up to the last time I saw them, but also dependent on what happened to them between, say, last year and this year. This would be a real problem in things like labor force studies, where if you're interested in the transitions from employed to unemployed, if somebody's become unemployed in the last year, there might be a bigger chance that they're not going to appear for this year's survey or interview than if they're employed. So that would be non-ignorable loss to follow-up. So it would be not missing at random in Rubin's terminology. So let me just give you an example of how one might study its effects using multi-state models. So suppose that I have a setting like this. Suppose I'm interested, like you could think of this as sort of employed and unemployed or something, but I'm just, for simplicity, supposing I'm focusing on estimating this transition intensity from one state to another state. Here's loss to follow-up. So I want to estimate this. These are nuisances, though. So from either of these states, let's suppose there's transition intensities going to loss to follow-up. Okay, now at inspection time AJ, if the person appears and I can look at them at time AJ, I can retrospectively determine the time of a 1 to 2 transition that occurred since I last saw them. So if they were employed last year, I see them this year, now they're unemployed, I can figure out when that happened, in other words. Okay, but of course if I can't see them this year, well, what do I do? Now, of course, what you want to do in ways is you say, right, I'll just take what? End of follow-up for that person is maybe the end of the previous year, but that might be problematic. Okay. Now, of course, if person is in state 3 at time AJ, that means I don't see them, and of course I don't know when they became lost to follow-up, and even might be a little bit of a fuzzy concept as to when that occurs. Now, when you get this non-MAR case is if alpha 1 is not equal to alpha 2. That makes sort of sense. If the probability somebody goes lost to follow-up is dependent on what state they're in, okay, but I can't observe that, then that's going to be non-MAR. And here's just a simple analysis that shows how you could look at that. So if I define, as before, the PI, JSTs as the transition probabilities, if we went ahead here now and just analyze these data by treating loss to follow-up as independent, in other words, I just ignored this potential problem, and what I did is I just took the end of follow-up time as the time I last saw the person, then there's a problem, because instead of estimating lambda of t, what I'm really doing is estimating not lambda of t, but the probability. Remember, lambda of t is the instantaneous probability of transition into state 2, right, at t. So you're not really estimating that, but you're estimating that, given that you're in state 1 just before time t, because you have to be in order to make the transition from state 1 to state 2, but also that at time aj you were in either state 1 or state 2, that you weren't in the loss to follow-up state, right? Because the only guys I see are the guys that satisfy that condition. Well, you can just, this is for a Markov model, but you just do this little calculation and you see that what you're estimating is not lambda t, but lambda of t depreciated, okay, by this factor here. So this is going to be a thing that's less than one. I won't try to say in words what that is. If you stare at that for a minute, you'll see it's a perfectly obvious, you know, what that's representing. Just in the simple case, so if you had just constant rates of transition to loss to follow-up from, let's say, the employed and unemployed states, and a constant transition intensity from state 1 to state 2, then for alpha 2 minus alpha 1 small, then this term, this attenuation factor, would be roughly this. And so what's going to happen is it's the further t is away from aj, the more the attenuation is. And but you'll notice what happens. If alpha 1 equals alpha 2, then there is no attenuation. So if the transition to loss to follow-up is the same for employed and unemployed, then no problem. Then the loss to follow-up is ignorable. Okay, so for correct estimation here, I'd have to do something. I could try modeling this. And if I had data on transitions to loss to follow-up from both states 1 and state 2, for example, I might be able to do something. Use of weights, inverse probability weights and stuff is another option. But generally speaking, of course, what you really need to do in these cases to really be certain, you know, in other words, to avoid making a lot of strong assumptions, you ideally should trace some of the people that are lost to follow-up. Now, what Statistics Canada does and what a lot of people do in these cases essentially is they model dropout, they model loss to follow-up as a function of things that have been observed about those subjects and hope in that case that it is then ignorable, or in other words, MAR. But that is a bit of a leap of faith. Okay. So in other words, with the employed-unemployed thing, you'd think if you modeled the loss to follow-up process, sort of like Jamie talked about and some other people earlier, if you modeled that in terms of a person's level of education and their age and maybe the sector of the economy they work in, you put those things in as covariates, then you'd sort of hope that having conditioned on those or adjusted for those, that the loss to follow-up would be independent. It's the standard trick. You got to do something to make your response, let's say whatever it is, a transition to another state at time t, conditionally independent of the dropout process, you know, given whatever it is you're conditioning on. Okay. Now, there's some other issues in observational studies that are somewhat similar and very thorny. So these Survey of Labor and Income Dynamics and other ones are studies where you do see people at equispaced time points, although the person might not appear, they might be lost to follow-up. But in a lot of studies that this isn't true. And so in a lot of studies, what you do is you get people are supposed to be seen or interviewed or observed sporadically, intermittently, but you know, some people haven't come back for a long time, or the times between interviews is very variable. So an example would be with the children with the cerebral spinal fluid shunts. I'll show you a plot of that in just a minute. Another interesting example is some work that Vern Farewell and I did with people at a rheumatic diseases clinic here in Toronto. But in this example here with the shunts, these are children that had the shunts inserted from between 1987 and the end of 1996, and then the data that we were looking at was data that up to the end of 1997. Okay. And what was supposed to happen is that the kids were supposed to come back to sick children's every 6 months or every year, roughly. So often, one reaction I often get is, you know, when you ask people, the people looking about at the database, they often maybe don't put down this kind of plot, but you say to them, you got very many people in there that you haven't seen in the last, say, maybe not a year, but 18 months, and they'll say, oh, no, just about everybody. But they probably know if they think about it a bit longer, no, there's probably some people I haven't seen for some time. Well, in fact, often the answer is there's a heck of a lot of people they haven't seen for a long time. What I'm showing you here is the reason this is triangular. Along here, day zero, these are the patients. There's around 900 or so here, ordered from, according to the time that they had this first shunt inserted and went into the database. So zero equals roughly January the 1st, 1986, and this is roughly the end of December 1986, I think. That was around 3,650 days there. I think it's 10 years, not 11, but okay. And then what we got along here is follow-up time, okay? Now, the people that went in on January the 1st, 86, they had a potential follow-up of a little over 4,000 days. Okay, this is in days, because it's 11 years of follow-up. Okay, so there's two symbols here, two plotting symbols. Some people died. So the pluses are the children that died. Obviously, they died. We don't see them anymore. But the dots show the time of last inspection or observation or the time last seen alive for the other people. Okay, well, let's suppose everybody were being seen no further apart than every 12 months. Then every one of those dots, aside from the pluses, the people who died, every one of those dots should be within a band along here that was 100, like was 1 year wide, right? But look at, you know, this guy's here, like, you know, this is somebody here who hasn't been seen for, you know, 2,000 days and this kind of thing. So an issue here is, if I want to do a study with these guys, what do I do about this? What should I take as the censoring time for one of these guys that I haven't seen for 2.5 years, see? I don't think I'd probably want to say, assume that they were still alive necessarily, if it was mortality I was looking at. They're still alive over here. Now, you can do kind of what you would often do, see to the pants analysis, probably do an analysis where you pick three or four putative censoring times, like one of them being the longest possible, one of them assuming that, you know, this is the censoring time, and doing separate analyses and see whether the results differ much. Okay, another area where there's really not a lot done is goodness of fit. So goodness of fit, typically, I think in complex models, you pretty well have to use model expansion. But even there are questions about effective methods. There's not a lot done here in this area. Of course, another way of testing fit is comparing a model-based and an empirical estimate. And I'll just mention here a paper by Vern Farewell and one of his PhD students where they attempted to look at sort of expected and observed transition counts, but in the difficult situation where people were not seen at equally spaced time points, so it's challenging. Another idea along the same line is you might want to look at prevalence probabilities, but these are the sorts of things where it would be interesting to have a little more methodology, and there's not too much. One possibility along the lines of the prevalence, though, there are some things you could do. So even with intermittent observation, for example, I can notice that the probability of being in state J at time T can be written this way. It can be written, if you let TJ and WJ denote the times of entry and exit from state J, for simplicity, assume that you can only enter state J once. This can be extended, but... And then PJT is just the probability that you entered state J before time T, but you didn't leave it before time T. So it's just the difference of two survivor functions, or CDFs. So I could estimate these guys non-parametrically. If I had continuous observation, I could use Kaplan-Meier estimates. If I don't, I could use like the Turnbull estimate for interval censored data. So I could actually estimate this empirically. And then I might compare that with what the results of my model give me. Okay? So there's issues about this sort of thing that could be explored. Now actually, there are some alternatives to this, too. I won't go into this, but I reference a paper there by Richard Cook and myself and that looks at this issue of estimating prevalence a little more closely. There's other ways than what I just showed you to do that. Another interesting area that's been talked a bit about, but there's very little work in this area, and this is kind of, here one thing is, sort of is this sort of thing feasible, but would be longitudinal multiphase observations. So studies where you follow people longitudinally in time, but some of the covariates are expensive or difficult to measure. So what I do is at each time point, I decide to measure a base set of covariates in everybody, but then I subsample some people to measure some additional covariates. Like this could be like, for example, you know, genetic, collect certain genetic information or something like that. And the thing I can do is I can base the decision as to which people to measure the additional covariates on their history, on their process history, if it's disease history, so on their past and current states occupied and on past and current covariate values. So this would be, I just give this as an example. This is a missing data problem because some people would have missing values for these covariates, and for some people they'd be there, but it's a challenging missing data problem, but it's a missing data by design problem, so it should be a little easier than just haphazardly missing covariate values. And your objective, of course, is to model the probability, you know, the transition process, you know, given both the hard to measure and the easy to measure covariates. In some cases, the easy to measure ones could be surrogates for the hard to measure ones and stuff. Like there's different variations on that. Another one that's just mentioned is measurement error. Another area where very little work, but again, in many studies, like in SLID, the time of events or values of covariates in the time interval since I last saw the person is retrospectively ascertained or measured. And the same for initial conditions. And so these are often subject to measurement errors. And there's almost no literature on this at all. Hardly anything. A little bit of work I know about in the longitudinal surveys area by Chris Skinner and people at Southampton. Very little work. Sometimes they make the decision not to collect that information. So for example, in a lot of longitudinal surveys, let's say with SLID, when a person's enrolled, so I see them for the first time, they've just entered the study, and they're going to be followed for 6 years, hopefully, and be seen once a year. But let's suppose they're unemployed when I see them at that first interview. Should I try to determine when they became unemployed? Well, it depends, you know. It would be nice to have that, but on the other hand, if I collect it and it's got substantial error, then maybe it's not such a good idea. So I'll just finish off in about 1 minute, leave a couple minutes for questions or comments, but there's also lots and lots of modeling issues. Basically, the thing I haven't commented on, it's quite hard to fit non-Markov models when you've got intermittently observed states. Like semi-Markov models and modulated Markov are difficult. People, earlier speakers mentioned the issues with time-dependent covariates. If you only see people every so often, then what do you do about imputing values for those, or just what should you do? Ability to check model assumptions also depends on how often you see people. So the level of modeling you adopt needs a kind of a judicious choice between assuming enough to get informative analysis, but not assuming so much that there's no way on earth to check it. I would just mention that some of these things, like if you see people at equispace time points, but even now increasingly if you see people at non-equispace time points, and there's work by, you know, Zhihong and Ray Carroll and lots of other people now on the longitudinal data area where they look at marginal models. So if you just wanted to model the probability that what state you're in at time t given covariates, but not conditioned on past history, there's quite a lot on that. But there's much less if I'm interested, as I really am here, in sort of transitional modeling. There's a little bit of work by Margaret Pepe and others on what they call partially conditional models and things. And then another area I haven't mentioned at all would be there is work also where there's latent process models, and there's been work by a few people where these are actually multi-state models, and I give one reference. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thanks for your attention. I'd be glad to answer questions or hear comments.